Good evening, family. My name is Tony Ahmed. About to kick this thing off, y'all. You know? Yeah. And I'm just really grateful for having the opportunity to be here, be a part of this convention. I've been to a lot of them. I started to come to CPRCNA on the third one. I won't forget that. And of course, I need to tell you all, I've heard many speakers up here say that when they had to do this, that they're nervous. And of course, I am as well. I'm not, I definitely know that I don't, I can't even think of what I'm trying to say, but definitely nervous, okay? But I'm going to work through that as well. I want to thank the Central Maryland area for asking me to come out and speak at this convention. I love the theme. You know, a dawn of a new reality is awesome. And I want to tell y'all, when I was told that I was going to come speak here, I was very surprised that, you know, I had been chosen to speak at the Friday night open meeting. When I submitted my tape, it was either for, they said, well, you know, we're going to submit you for Friday night or a workshop. And I was cool with that. But prior to 2 weeks before, I was told that I was going to be the main speaker. On February 2nd, February 3rd, I ended up in the hospital. And I was diagnosed with an aortic aneurysm. They call it a triple A. And I've been walking around with it for several years, not knowing, you know, that I had this thing inside of me. And if anybody knows what that is, I'll try and briefly describe it to you. It's where your aorta blows up like a balloon, and if it bursts, you're gone. Real simple, I mean. And I'm blessed that mine did blow up. That's the God of my understanding, and I want to say this because it's important for me to just share this with you, fellas. We're not like the women. We don't get the ultrasounds where they go and look inside our body and see what's wrong. You know, we come in here, and there's a lot of things wrong with us, and I didn't know that I was walking around with this thing in me, you know, where and a simple test where they do this, I forget what it's called again. Ultrasound, there we go. An ultrasound, a simple ultrasound detected this thing and saved my life, for real. So I just wanted to mention that. If you've never had an ultrasound, get one. It's a silent killer, y'all. People are dying from this stuff. So I just wanted to put that out there. But 2 weeks after I had the surgery and I came home and I was recovering from it, I'm still recovering from it. You know, I got a call that Tony had been selected to be the main speaker for Friday night, and wow, I was totally surprised and shocked and honored and thankful. So anyway, I'm going to try and get to the business of sharing my experience, strength, and hope. You know, I've heard a lot of people talk about, well, I'm just going to get to my story. They say, share your story, Tony. Share your story. You're good at sharing your story. And I thank God for a great sponsor and a great grand sponsor when I got here, because my grandfather would take me around to detox. He would take me around to detox, and he was saying, Tony, you need to learn how to tell your story. You know, and that was probably the greatest thing that could have ever happened to a guy like me. I got here to Narcotics Anonymous in October 18th, 1988. And by the grace of God, I've been able to stay here ever since then. But my journey started way before then. Actually, the first time I was ever introduced to this program was in 1986 in San Diego, California. I had just got married to a young lady that was in the military. I had known her for a while. We had worked together, I guess you could say, a few years earlier. I had run into her probably a couple years before that in Los Angeles, California. And this is me walking the streets of Los Angeles, practically, well, homeless. I was homeless, man, walking the streets of L.A. trying to figure out what I'm going to do. And I remember walking down the street and seeing this group of people going inside this church. And I was like, what are these people going to? And something told me to walk inside this church, y'all. And I don't know why I did it, but I walked inside the church. And when I walked in there, I saw this young lady, and I had known her. We had worked together before. She was in the military, and she had just come back from overseas to the States. And you know, here I am, funky, grubby, and stuff, man. And I saw her walking in this room, and you know, she let me know that she was back, and she said she was back in San Diego, and we spoke, and I left there, and it was kind of weird. I don't know why I was drawn to that place, but I'll tell you why in a little bit. But so what happened, I went back out on the street, man, and for the next couple of years, man, for a little while, I eventually left L.A. and went back to San Diego. Actually got run out of L.A. You know, it wasn't fun. I hit a lot of bottoms, and I'm going to kind of jump around a little bit because my mind is kind of like wandering, trying to figure out where I really wanted to start. But I'm going to even back up a little bit further than that before I got here, because I think it's an important part of my story, at least. You know, I talked about San Diego. That's when I first got introduced to a 12-step program. But something really important part of how and who I am has to do with how I was raised. And it was important for me to hear when I got to Narcotics Anonymous, people share this because it helped me to identify in versus identifying out. And, I was raised in little small areas. I was born in Clovis, New Mexico, raised in Pueblo, Colorado, and Odessa, Texas. These little small towns in the Midwest, right? My dad was a minister. And he's real crazy. I mean, this man spoke in front of large congregations, but behind closed doors, he was a monster. And I needed to share that because I remember when, you know, we had to do a lot of church back in that time. And I remember I used to go to church, man, and I questioned, what the hell, you know, I questioned it because I couldn't understand how a God would allow somebody like this to be in front of a congregation. I couldn't understand because of where I lived at and the people that I lived around and the time that I came up. You know, I was raised around a lot of white folks. And it was prejudice. We went through hell. We fought hell in the Midwest. Being the only black person in a school with all white people, you know, you're defending yourself all the time. And that's what I found myself doing. But then to come home and defending myself at home as well. Insane. You know, so, and when I would go to church, I'd see this man on the cross, and I'd be, you know, like, I don't believe in him, you know. But even though I said that, I kind of like said, something's wrong with religion, and I kind of like went the other way. We dealt with a lot of the physical abuse, the emotional abuse. I saw a lot of physical abuse toward my mom and caught a lot of it myself. And we also experienced some sexual abuse. And so, I didn't like my family. And we moved around a lot. And I don't know why we did all that, but I know I'm going to say, to try to get to the meat of this, we were living in Pueblo, Colorado. And my mom had sent my sister away because, you know, my dad kept attacking me. And she sent her away to live with my grandmother on her side. And I remember she was getting ready to graduate from high school. And we were going to go visit her. And it was early Saturday morning, or Friday morning, I'm sorry. It was Friday. It was the end of school. I was in grade school. I'll never forget it. And I remember getting up and going to the kitchen table and sitting down and eating. And then I heard a gunshot. And I heard my oldest brother yelling, "John, shot himself, John, shot himself." And we go running outside, and my brother is sitting in my dad's truck, and he had put my dad's revolver to his head, and he had pulled the trigger. And I couldn't understand what happened. I didn't know what happened. I was kind of in shock. I remember I stood there and I saw him in the cab of the truck and saw the blood everywhere and just, you know, I didn't know what to do. I'm a kid, you know, like most of us. And I remember my dad came home and he was crying and my mom was crying and I turned around and I walked to school like nothing happened. Stuffed all that emotion, man. Stuffed it. And I remember the teachers found out at school that my brother had died, and they said, "What are you doing at school?" And they sent me back home. You know, and it took a while. It was kind of crazy, but, you know, it wasn't, and I'm going to kind of jump around, but I want to put the pieces together like this because it'll be easier for me so I won't lose the train of thought. But I didn't realize why my brother shot himself until I came into recovery now. And it wasn't until I was several years clean where I had a meeting with my family, you know, my brothers and sisters, and we were sitting, and my mom, and we were sitting, we were talking, and I found out that my brother shot himself because he was thinking, he was afraid that my sister was going to come back home. And he used to sleep in front of my sister's door to keep my dad out of it. And that's why he didn't want this no more. He couldn't deal with it no more. And I'm saying, it's kind of weird because when I came to this program, I realized that narcotics kept my ass alive until I got here. Because I was feeling the same way. What a desire that just didn't know how to do. But was killing myself, stuffing them feelings. Shortly after my brother died, we moved to California. And that's why I kind of call California home, because I went to junior high school there and stuff. You know, made a lot of my friends there. But first time I got around black folk, y'all, is when I moved to California. And I'm gonna tell y'all, I caught hell. I thought I had arrived, but I caught hell. I came to California, man, and I had short hair and high water pants. I talked real proper. And you know, everybody had Jerry curls back then and they could dance real good. Man, I caught hell. You know, so, you know, I didn't want it like that. I wanted to be a part of it. You know, I was like, shit, this can't be like this, man. I didn't want to be fighting everybody every day, you know. I got to do something to try and be a part of. You know, all I wanted to do was be accepted, be a part of, man. And to me, the people that were cool, the people that were being accepted, the people that I thought was, you know, had it going on, were the people that was cutting class, people that was getting high, you know, the athletes, of course, you know, the ones that could dance real good and was slick, and I was like, shit, I could do like that. I want to be like that, you know, and so I started trying to follow those people around, and you know, and I'm gonna give you an example of how my thinking is, I'm coming out of the boys' bathroom, I'm not going to call it the men's bathroom, I was coming out of the boys' bathroom, and one of the most popular girls in the school was being taken into the girls' bathroom by a whole bunch of women, and she was shaking, and she was sweating, and her eyes were rolling in her head, and I'm coming out of the boys' bathroom, and I see all the people around her, and I'm saying, what happened to her? And they said, she OD'd. You know, and she had drank, I don't know if it was alcohol or what it was, but she had, they said basically she had OD'd, and they were trying to protect her. And I'm thinking to myself, man, I want to be just like her. That's insane. I want to be just like her because she had all those people around her. You know, that's what I wanted. And I was like, I set out to do just that, man. And that's when my journey really began to drink and drug and try to be a part of, And man, I'm telling you, I went far to the right. Things were still crazy at home. And so what I started doing to deal with life at home, man, is I would run away. I didn't want to be at home, man. And I'd run away and be on the street all night. I didn't know what to do. There's times I'd walk the street all night long, man, and just, you know, sleep where I could. Thank God it was California. Because not all the time it was cold like out here. Times I'd slip in the movie theaters and spend the night in the movie theater, or somebody, I'd run into a college kid and he'd let me sleep in their dorm. And then I started finding, you know, the players and the pimps, and I'd start hanging out with them and they'd let me crash at their house. And so that's kind of like how it went, and that's the kind of people I started to really hang out with. And the police would catch me. And they'd try to send me back home, you know. The first couple of times I went back. And then, you know, as it kept on going, as I kept on running away, they would try to take me back home. And I said, I don't want to go home, man. I don't want to go back to that insanity that was going on in my house. And they gave me counselors. They tried to find out what was wrong with me. And I wouldn't tell nobody anything. I couldn't tell them what was going on in my home. You know, I just couldn't tell them. Until one day, my dad packed me. Now, I got there was nine of us, five boys, four girls. Four boys, four girls after my brother took his life. But he packed us all up in the car. He took us across the border to Mexico one night. And he was raving, going crazy. And he scared me to death, man. I mean, I'm sitting in this car, man, and I'm thinking this man I didn't know what to do, but I'm terrified. And I remember somehow, you know, my mom talked him into taking us back, bringing us back across the border, bringing us back home. And I remember that next day, man, I went and I told somebody. And they approached him. And when they approached him, man, he nutted up, man. He went off. And he went to his first psych. He was institutionalized. I mean, he went to his first psych ward, basically. And that gave my mom the chance to get away from him. So we were thankful for that. Now, I'm going to correlate that to recovery, y'all, because that meeting I was talking about that we had with my family, where I found out about my brother, I found out something else. My mom told me that night that we were in Mexico that he had his revolver in the car and he wanted to kill us. And somehow or another, she talked him into bringing us back. Nobody knew that I took my dad in. I didn't tell nobody in my family, man, because you know, I just didn't tell anybody. I was scared to tell anybody. But I told my mom that night, and I told my brothers and sisters that night, that I'm the one that turned him in. My mom said, man, if he wouldn't have, he probably would have killed us. You know, and so it's like, wow. What a blessing. You know, when I look back over my life and I look at all the insanity that went on, and I wonder, would I be standing here today had that not taken place in my home? And I've listened to so many stories over the years, so many stories of addicts that have come from good homes, good families, raised right, had all the stuff they needed, yet they're sitting in the room with me. You know, so I want to just say that because I'm sharing this little horror story doesn't mean that everybody that goes through what I went through becomes an addict. The disease of addiction, I don't know why it takes me out of my family. There's only two people in my family that were in this program, and that was my sister and myself. I came in years before she came in, and she came in years later. But let me share with y'all how I actually got here, because it means a lot to me. Obviously, how you get to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you heard me talk about the people that I role modeled myself after. My role models were the pimps and players. I didn't want to have nothing to do with God. I didn't want to have nothing to do with religion. You know, I ran from that, man, because I believed, and the way I was living my life, man, I just believed that, you know, God didn't want to have nothing to do with me either. So, you know, I rolled for a while, man, and, you know, trying to find a place out there in the street, man, as a player, as a pimp, you know. I DJed, I danced. I'm probably one of the first male exotic dancers in California when they first started that stuff. Yeah, you know, so I did a little bit of everything out there. Now that's something I don't even share in my group, my homies, though. You know, it's probably the first time they probably heard that stuff, right? But I just don't talk about that stuff immediately because I don't want people to think I'm glorifying the shit that I did out there in the life, man. I did a lot of shit out there in the life. A lot of us have done a lot of shit out there in the life. So I've shared it with y'all. Now everybody knows. Oh, they know now. Yeah. And I'm gonna tell you it's fun in the beginning, but man, you know. That it's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle, man. And I'm going to tell you, I did a lot of stuff out there, man, and I was twisted. I was twisted inside because here it is, a young man that got this twisted message of God and religion because, trust me, I went to a lot of church. I read the Bible. We used to do Bible drills in church. I used to be a little junior minister, had to get up and talk in front of the congregations and stuff. You know, so I knew something about religion. Yeah, and so you add to that, being out in the street and doing all the shit I was doing in the street, there was a conflict going on inside. And the only way to calm that conflict was to keep getting high. I did not want to look at reality. I needed to keep putting something on top of that stuff, man. Keep putting something on top of it. Just not to feel, not to think. Lost a lot of things out there, man. I used to wake up year after year, man, and look at my life and think, man, damn, you know, different woman, different, you know, different house, different apartment, you know. Some years homeless, you know, doing a lot of dirty stuff, I was treacherous, man. You know, before I would get in one relationship with a woman, I had another one already started, so I could just smooth transition, as I call it. Womanizer, man. You know, had no character. Didn't care about nobody except for Tony. You know, self-seeking, self-serving. And I'm so blessed, man. I know I'm truly blessed that I never ended up in an institution. Because it's not like I didn't do stuff to end up in one. Because I did. It's only by the grace of God that for whatever reason, why God allowed my path to be the way it is. Thank you. It just didn't go that direction. But what happened, I'm going to back up. So what happened to bring me to Narcotics Anonymous is 1986, that woman I ran into in Los Angeles, California. I had come back to San Diego. In 85, I think around 85, I had come back to San Diego. And what I had done is I had taken my son from his mother because she was using, I was using, and I thought I was better off than she was. You know? And for real, why I took him, is because I figured I could get on welfare. That's what it was. That's what it was all about. I needed a paycheck. And I know they always get it, whoever got the kids, the money. And I needed to get off the street, and I didn't know how I was going to do it this time. And I figured if I had him, maybe I could get... And I really, there was a part of me that wanted to get my life together. I just didn't know how. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know nothing about the program. Didn't know anything about the 12-step program. And so this time, I remember we ended up in the shelter for a while, my brother gave me a job at his place, and I found my first apartment up above this garage in Chula Vista, California. And eventually what happened is I ran into some female. I'm starting to get my stuff together now. I'm not using drugs, but I'm drinking alcohol, not thinking that alcohol is a drug. Didn't know that. Didn't understand all that stuff yet. And I met a female and I moved in with her and started doing that thing again until I met my then future wife, who I had met in LA, and she was still in the military. She was getting ready to go overseas to Japan. And I thought, and she wanted a husband. She didn't want to go over to Japan by herself. And I was like, shoot, that's good. You want me for your husband? I'm down with that. But I was like, she got a steady paycheck. But more than that, there was attraction now. There was an attraction. The attraction with her is she believed in God in a way that I didn't. And I saw that too. So that was attraction as well. Y'all, a part of me don't want to share this part of the story because I'm going to tell y'all why I don't want to share this part of the story, because there's a young lady sitting in here tonight who's got 2 years clean, who's my daughter, and that's her mother. But I'm going to tell y'all, God don't make no mistakes. God put me with this woman, man, because that's when recovery began for me. Like I said, she believed in God in a way that I didn't. It wasn't too long after we got married, she found out I was an addict. I did one of those addict moves. She was on base, and I was at home. I wasn't working. And I was going through the bank account, smoking through the bank account. I was supposed to pick her up that night, and I never made it there. And I'll never forget it. Somewhere around 10:30 that night, she finally made it home. And I remember she met me at the door, trying to go out for another run, right? She met me at the door, and I'm like beaming, you know, head like your own, dude. I'm beaming for it, Lord have mercy. But then she scared the shit out of me too, because I'm like busted. And I had explained to her what the heck was going on. And of course, for the first time I copped to somebody that I'm an addict. And I think the only reason I copped to it is because, I don't know why, you know, we do whatever we do because we do what we do. So I just copped to it. I don't know what the hell is going to happen. And she said, you need to get some help. And I'm like, what the fuck am I supposed to do? I don't know what to do. She said, you need to get your treatment. I'm like, okay. All right, well, what is treatment going to do for me? So she said, well, you need to call one of those hospitals and they get you in the treatment facility and they'll help you. I'm like, okay, I'll do that. And I'm thinking in my mind, I said, okay, I'll call one of these treatment facilities. Maybe they're going to give you some drugs and they can get better. Had no clue. So I went to my first treatment center the early spring of 1986 in San Diego, California. And interesting as it was, I made the phone call. I went down there. I didn't know what the hell they were going to do now. I'm going to tell y'all something. Before I went to the treatment facility, man, I had been using cocaine, speed, like 725. My mind, I was not a vision for you. Let me put it like that. I was pretty fucked up. And mind you, my MO, my mode of operation was when shit didn't go right, Tony, run. I'm a runner. I ran from everything. So I went to this treatment facility. And there's one other thing. Anybody hear what cocaine psychosis is? Okay, so I was suffering from that and had no clue. Cocaine psychosis is just freaking paranoid. You start coming down off that stuff, you're paranoid of everything. And what I found out was, when I, you know, you take the cocaine away from me, you detox me, I was paranoid as shit. I remember the first time they took me to an outside meeting, they took me to the Elder Fellowship. Somebody came up and gave me the reading. They said, can you read this when the meeting starts? I said, sure. And I started reading it to myself. And it was How It Works. And I said, oh shit, these people want me to talk about myself. I said, if they get me to talk about myself, they're gonna lock me up. I'm already in a nut house, right? But I believe, man, that I needed to stay in a nut house. I believe I needed to be locked down in jail. I needed to be in a nut house because I didn't think that I could live out here like other people. I believe that's where I needed to be. I didn't think there was a way. And I was reading that thing and I was like, oh shit, they're gonna get me to talk about myself. And then another young lady that was in the program with me, she was sitting next to me, she was crying. I said, shit, she knows about it too. Man, I got up and left. I left that program. But by the grace of God, I didn't pick up. I called my sister and I told her what had happened. And she must have known, boy, good Lord. She said, this love, he's crazy as shit. I know she felt that way. She talked me into going back to that program. I didn't use, and I went back. And I finished that 30-day, it was a 30-day program. I finished it. And, you know, and so I got to share this with y'all because it's something really interesting happened to me while I was in there. One thing that stands out in my mind that I just want to share with you is because I remember one time we were having this little group session, right? And the counselor told one of the guys to stay back. He just wasn't getting it, right? He just couldn't get it. And so he had him go to the chalkboard and he said, I want you to go up here and I want you to draw a gravestone. And he did that. He said, now I want you to write an obituary to cocaine. And he started writing this obituary. And as he was writing this obituary, I'm back in the back crying my behind off. I'm just crying like, oh my God, like I'm burying somebody, right? It was crazy. I just wanted to share that with you. But anyway, that was crazy. I don't know if anybody else gets that, but I got it. But it showed me how attached that I was to my drugs, man. That was my drug. Mine was cocaine. Mine was freebase. Crack. The monster out. But I made it through that 30-day treatment program, and my wife and I, we went overseas to Japan. I started going to meetings on base there. Now, mind you, I had never been introduced to Narcotics Anonymous at this point. And to be in the military, you can't be an addict. Back then, you couldn't be an addict and be in the military because you were an addict. And if you admitted that you were an addict, they would put you out of the military. So on the military base, they only had the other fellowship. And that's where I went. Now, I'm going to tell you, I identified in what they were talking about. There was a guy that used to talk about the grill, and if he drank, he would be letting the grill out the cage. I understood that. I listened to him. I heard them share that stuff. But I was still this person that couldn't share anything. Surface. I couldn't tell you how I really felt. I couldn't tell you what was going on inside of me. Because I really believed that if you knew me like I knew me, you would hate me like I hated me. You would run from me like I wish I could run from myself. I hated me, man. And as I got clean and I started seeing that person that did all that nasty shit out there, man, I hated him even more. And how could you share that with anyone? How can you share something that you hate so much yourself? How do you do it? Well, I'm going to tell you what happens if you don't do it. You pick up. Because that's what I did. I picked up because I wanted to go back in the darkness. I felt like if I could push that shit back down again like I used for so long and live back in darkness, I'd be okay. But it didn't work. It didn't work. The alcohol didn't work, and so I was like, I gotta have some drugs, man. I need what I do. I remember before when you get to Japan, they give you this little orientation thing, what happens to Americans if you're caught with drugs. And I thought about that and I was like, man, I don't wanna stay here. I don't wanna go to Japanese prison. Don't wanna do that, man. And And so I reached out to the Joint Substance Abuse Counseling Center and told them I needed some help, man. I think for the first time, I was willing to talk about the incest, talk about the abuse that was going on in my home, man. Talk about how I responded to it, how I acted out as a result of things that had happened to me. And they said, okay, we're going to send you guys back stateside. And I was supposed to come to this area, actually to D.C. I was supposed to be going to treatment. So they sent us back out here in I think it was somewhere like in July of 88. Landed at Bowling Air Force Base when we got to D.C. And I started going to meetings immediately. My first meeting was at Bowling Air Force Base. It was AA. But what happened is from there I sprung out and found NA. You guys, when I walked into my first NA meeting, I knew I had arrived. I knew this was the place. You guys spoke about what I needed to hear. People were talking about the stuff that mattered. Y'all were talking about the stuff that I was scared to talk about. Y'all gave me the courage to start sharing. Now, mind you, I still didn't think this thing would work for me. I didn't believe Narcotics Anonymous would work for me, man. But I was coming to meet them. I didn't have a sponsor at the time, but I was coming to meet them. And I was waiting on them to go to the treatment facility. And so after being here for a couple of months, we got a car. I remember this is a big thing, you know, you get a car. And it's always good when you get to a new location to get a car, right? John? And so I remember riding around somewhere in Southeast D.C. and saw this young lady on the corner. And she looked like she needed a ride. So I stopped and gave her a ride. She's one of the cops, man. I was trying to go too. That thing inside me was calling me, man. It was calling me, man. And it always calls me through a woman. It always called me first through a woman. That was my, that hit me every time, right? And I went cops. I used that day. I remember I went back out there the next day and found another woman out there on the corner. And picked her up too. And we went back out to try to cop again. And I remember, I don't know where, I didn't even know where I was, but I know there was a lot of guys outside of this complex that we stopped at. And she got out the car and she went over and then she came back and she said, they ain't gonna tell nothing to you. I said, why not? They think you the police. I'm like, shit. I'm like, oh, okay. And so she got out the car. And I sat there in that car and I was like thinking, oh my God, I want to get high, man. I want to use. And as I sat there, I heard this little voice. And it said, Tony, if you get out this car and you use, you're going to use for a long time. Man, that touched me like nothing has ever touched me before. That little simple little voice. Man, I turned that car around. I drove it home, man. And I remember dropping to my knees, man, and I said, God, please help me. And I don't want to take my wife from here. That began the day of my recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. Really strange how things work. My wife and I went to the intake for me to go into this treatment facility. And I told my wife that I had used. And I'll never forget, she stood over me and she was crying. She said, don't you know you're killing yourself? And I'm thinking to myself, but I'm okay. I'm okay. In denial, right? I was not okay, but I didn't know it. I didn't know it. Needless to say, she was done. We made a decision we were going to separate at that time. And you know, that's kind of hard because you have me in a strange city. I don't have no job. You know, usually I'd have had another woman before I leave one. That ain't happening. I can't go back to California, you know, and I got a daughter, you know, and I was tired of running. And I didn't know what to do. I really didn't know what to do with it. Well, I'm going to tell you, things happen for a reason. We kind of went back and forth with this leaving and you're going to leave or whatever, but it was a Saturday morning. Normally I would be out for a meeting, and I was sitting there on the telephone when my wife walked in the room and she says, "Well, what are you still doing here?" I said, I'm trying to find a place to live. You want me out of here? So I was making phone calls. And I said, "Why?" She says, "I got company coming over." Like, company coming over? I'm a little slow, but I ain't that slow. Y'all, I kind of figured it out. I mean, but I couldn't say anything else to her at that moment because if I would have, I really believe that, I would have hurt her. And so the only thing I could do, man, was leave. It was a Saturday. I walked out the house. I got in the car. We was living on Bates. I remember I drove across the street, down the street, into the commissary where I could see my house. And I sat there and I got the jack handle out the back of my trunk. And I said, "When this motherfucker gets me, I'm gonna kill him. I'm gonna kill her." Obviously, I didn't because I'm here, okay? But that, I really thought about it. But what happened, I had been to a few NA meetings at this point in time, and something said, "Man, you don't want to go to jail for the rest of your life. You need to get out of here." And there was this club that I knew about, it's called Pathfinders. In D.C. I remember I went up there and I sat down and I said, "I'm gonna wait here until meeting starts," you know, because I could. That's what it was for, you know. And I hung around there until the meeting started, man. And I remember when that meeting started, man. And I raised my hand and I said, "I'm Tony, I'm an ad," and I shared with him what just had happened. And I said, "I don't know what to do." And I'll tell you, man, after that meeting, people came, surrounded me, man, they gave me phone numbers, you know, and this one young lady in particular, she gave me a number, she said, "Tony, call this man, he could be your sponsor, he can help you," you know, and I'm like, okay, and I'm thinking about where am I going to be sleeping tonight, because I'm thinking I'm sleeping in my car, right? You know, we're talking about October, it's September, right? And September, I think it was, and she said, "Well, why don't you come home with me and my girlfriend tonight? And we'll call around, we'll see if we can find you a place to stay." And she was talking about one of these recovery houses, right? I didn't know this child from somebody, 17-year-old girl, telling me to come home with her and her girlfriend. I was scared, but I didn't have nowhere else to go, so I went with her. And when we got to her house, she got on the phone and she started calling around. She knew people. She'd been around the fellowship for a while. And she got me in an interview that Sunday at one of those houses. That Sunday we went there, they interviewed me. Now, she told me to lie, because I only had a couple weeks clean, though. She said, "You got to be 30 days clean in order to get this house. So you need to tell them you got 30 days." I said, "Okay." They let me into that house, man. That was a Sunday. I ain't had no money to pay the rent. I didn't know where I was. I didn't have a job. But they let me in anyway. I said, "Don't worry about it. We got you until you get the job. So you start working." That next day, that Monday, I went out looking for a job and found a job the same day. You know, that was like, when I look back at that, man, it's like God rolled out the red carpet, but he needed to kick my ass on it to get my recovery jump started, man. And that's kind of like how I started, you know? I'm going to tell you, it's tough. I used to go to meetings, man, and I hear people sharing and they be talking about God. Man, I had that was difficult for me to sit in a meeting and hear the word God. I struggled with that. And I used to talk to the sponsor guy on the phone because I didn't know who he was yet. I'd call him 3-4 times a day. My first job, by the way, was a telephone operator. So it was good because I could call people all the time, right? And heck, I didn't even have the right clothes to wear to this job. I'm going to show you how God works. I got this job working for this It was called a Big Five accounting firm, right? The kind of clothes that I had to come to work with were the kind of clothes you see somebody in a club. You know, leather suits, silk suits, you know, stuff like that, party clothes. Not stuff that people would go to work with. Not something like what I got on today, right? And then people liked me so much when I came there. I don't know why, but the manager, which the managing partner, and was able to get money for me to buy clothes to work at the job, to be able to come to work. Stuff like that was happening in my life, and I couldn't understand. I didn't think people did kind stuff like that. I hadn't experienced kindness in so long, I didn't even know that that kind of stuff existed. But that's how it worked for me. And I kind of jumped around again, because I was in a meeting, and talking about God. But I would tell you, I struggled with that, right? And but you know, I kept coming back, and my sponsor said, Tony, you know, you're going to meet and sit on your hands, but just don't get up. Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle. Don't get up, you might miss something that'll help you get through this. You know, and I was still afraid to share my story though, y'all. I was still afraid to tell y'all who I was. Although, I started sharing a little bit. I started giving piecemeal out because I hear you talk about this stuff. I heard mostly the women that were talking about the incest. They're talking about how they were getting through it and things that had happened. And they gave me courage to start talking about it. And then there was a part of me that thought, man, you know, this shit is just too deep. It's too heavy, man. I don't want to remember. I don't want to talk about this stuff. I don't want to feel this stuff. I didn't like the way that stuff felt, man. And I realized, it took me a little while, but I realized that, you know, I had some grave emotional and mental disorders as a result of some of the things that I went through in my childhood. And those things needed to be addressed. I was afraid. I felt safer in a meeting than I did one-on-one with anybody. So my sponsor, for the first 3 months, man, I talked to this man on the phone. Every day, but on the phone. And I finally got the courage to finally go and meet him one-on-one. But I'll tell you, as I started to share my story, as I started sharing a little bit of peace with myself, what I found was that people didn't run away from me. That y'all embraced me. You embraced me. You loved me. And that, it was really, it blew me away, man. I'm one of them guys that came to a lot of meetings, man, and I cried. I think my first couple years, man, I cried at almost a lot of the meetings I went to, man, cleansing my soul, as they were telling me. I'd come home sometimes and look in the mirror and say, and couldn't figure out, I mean, look at this big guy and say, you cry like that, man? What's wrong with you? But people would keep saying, man, it's okay, man. Let that shit out. Cleanse your soul, brother. You know, it's okay to cry, man. So, I'm going to kind of take y'all through some of my journey in recovery. I'm thinking about around, when I was about around 9 months, man. I didn't know this, but I really, man, they say suit up and show up. I'm going to tell you how powerful that is. And you ain't got to use it even if you want to use it. That was so powerful to me. That stuff was so powerful to me, man, because I would suit up and show up in spite of how I felt, in spite of whatever I was thinking about. I tried to get in the middle of this thing because I didn't think I could make it. You know, they said, if you get in the middle of it, you won't fall off the edge. And I just didn't think I could make this. I didn't think it would work. And then I heard somebody else say, stay here long enough until your mind clears up enough that you can make a just healthy decision if you want this as a way of life. And I said, I think I can do that. I think I can do that, man. And but some things happened. Right around nine months, I remember I had left this recovery house. I'm living with another guy, and you know, he worked night shift, I worked the day shift, so it was perfect. And I'm laying in bed one morning, and I had something that occurred, and I didn't know what it was. And it scared me to death. Some of y'all might understand this and some of y'all might not, but I'm going to share it with you. It's something they call a body memory. Anybody hear what a body memory is? Okay, I'm going to share what a body memory is. I'm laying in bed, man, and my body starts responding to something, to a stimuli that happened many, many years ago as a part of a memory. Scared me so much, I'm ready to jump out the window. Because my body's responding to stimuli that ain't happening right now. I'm thinking I'm losing my damn mind. I get on the phone, I call my sponsor, I'm crying like a baby on the phone to my sponsor. And we work through this. And what I found out through this experience, y'all, that some people need more help than others. And I realized at that point in time that I need to go outside and get help. And so I reached out to get some outside help. You know, and I thank God for that. I also found out something else that a lot of us experience while we're in recovery, and we start to get clean. A lot of us have depression. And I was suffering with that too, and was undiagnosed for depression. Until I got so depressed that I couldn't really function. The pain was so great that I didn't know what to do, and I actually reached out, and I had a really great network. My network was so wonderful that I was able to go, actually, I went away for 30 days, man, just to address the depression. And even when I came back, and I got through that 30-day program to help me deal with the depression and came back, you know, I struggled with taking the medication to deal with depression. Because I, you know, somebody in a, you know, in the, especially back during when I was getting clean, you know, we were very resistant about taking drugs for anything, you know. Now, some people would say, you know, we're not doctors in here. Do what you need to do. And thank God I had a sponsor who told me the same thing. But I'm still impressionable when my peers are, you know, talking about, you know, we don't take drugs no matter what. But one day, I was sitting in a meeting. And I was thinking. And I said, you know what? I'm really struggling with this issue about treating my depression and having to take antidepressants for my depression. So I said, you know, and I was sharing this, and I said, I just need to know. Can you raise your hand if you have to take antidepressants for depression? And practically 3/4 of the people in the room raised their hand. And I was, oh my God. What the hell am I, what am I afraid of? Treat yourself, boy. Treat yourself. Treat that stuff. If you're depressed, treat your depression. Don't die, man. Don't let yourself die because of this shit, man. And I'm going to tell you, not only did I treat it, but I was continuing to get outside help. I did that for several years in this area before I moved back to California to be with my family. I moved back to California because I had a son that was struggling. And I thought, he sounded like I did. He sounded like he was hoping, like he had no hope that things would get better for him. And I wanted to go back and be with him and try and help him, help guide him, give him some of what I had gotten in recovery. And I remember going back there and being able to be in his life. It's interesting. I think I'm going to try to speak this up because I realize that I'm only supposed to speak for an hour, right? Yeah, I think I got about 10 or 15 minutes, so I want to kind of get to out of a few things. But I was able to go back to California. I remember I got around my family again, my mom and my brothers and stuff. And at this point in time, I had about 2 years clean, 2.5 years clean, and they didn't believe that I was clean, right? Because I remember my first meeting, they trying to give me beer, want me to drink, and I wouldn't drink it, you know. And they saw that I, you know, it took time to show them that I wasn't an alcoholic. And after being there for several years, and developing a relationship with my mom and stuff, and doing that, getting the outside help, I came to a place where I was able to come off the antidepressants. And I felt really good about that. I was like, man, you know, it's time, you know? And when I came off the antidepressants, what I The first thing that challenged that was my mom was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And the first thing that came to my mind, because this all happened in the same week when I made the decision and came off the antidepressant, the first thing that came to my mind is, you're going to get depressed again, Tony. You're going to have to take that medicine again. Now, I'm here to report, I've never had to pick up antidepressants again. I've worked through that stuff, man. Between that and narcotics knowledge, between working the steps, finding the God of my understanding, I have not had to go back to that. You know, and just saying that just brings me back to the fact that the God of my understanding, y'all, what helped me and what sustained me was finding God that was a loving and caring and forgiving God. And it wasn't my parents' God, it wasn't the religious God that I came up with. That's the stuff that sustained me. That's the stuff that helped me get through. And that's the stuff that helped me to be there when my mom went through this illness. And to be there, be present through the whole process. And thank God for Narcotics Anonymous, man, because as I went through that process, y'all went through that process with me, man. Y'all went through it with me. I didn't have to go through it alone. They said we never have to go through anything alone with Narcotics Anonymous, and that's been proven the pudding for me for many years. After my mom died, I need to say, I came back to this area. I didn't get to share with y'all, I had remarried through this whole process. My daughter was getting bigger, you know, my son still struggling through his own, trying to still find his way, but I think he's starting to find his way. He just doesn't want to find him in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. Bless his heart, I can't say he's an addict. He's got to find his own way, but he's finding his way right now. And I came back to this area, and I had to go through a lot of, it's been a lot of challenges, man. The longer you stay clean, you're going to go through some challenges. I came back here, and my first sponsor passed away. My grand sponsor passed away the year after that. You know, as you say, you say clean, man, you start losing people, man. People start dying on you, man. This is where it happens and where it takes place in me. Then some of my sponsees start dying. I had a sponsee die last year, and I had one that died this year. And the one that died this year, even Larry C. Larry C, man, we really thought he was going to pull through it. You know, and he died of a liver transplant, yeah. And he just didn't make it, man. And it touched a lot of us in this area that knew him. But there was a group of us, man, that stuck by him and was with him through that whole process. And, you know, and it's just a testament of Narcotics Anonymous, a testament of this program and what it does to us and how it helps us to be selfless. You know, and, you know, I find, man, that what this program has done for me, man, is helped me to focus on not so much myself all the time as on other folks in the world. Not only in Narcotics Anonymous, but people around me, man. I mean, this thing has allowed me to open up and be a lot bigger than I've ever been. I'm a reasonably happy man today because of Narcotics Anonymous, I've got to say. And, I don't even know where to take it from here. All I can tell you is I am so thankful that Narcotics Anonymous has given me a God of my understanding. I am so thankful that he's put a lot of wonderful people in my life. I'm thankful for the sponsors that are still in my life. I'm thankful for 2 years ago, after this convention was over. This is interesting, y'all. 2 years ago, after this convention was over, and everybody was leaving and going on back home and stuff, I'm standing out front, and I'm looking over at an addict who sits there alone and looks lost. And I remember I walked over to this addict, and we sat down and we started chatting. And it was interesting because I don't know if he you seem like I did when I first got here. Hopefully, not sure if this was going to work. And he just went through a beautiful convention, and I don't know if he was convinced, y'all. And so I challenged that ass. I said, man, I'm going to be here next year. I challenge you to stay clean this next year. And that man stayed clean. He's sitting on the front row over here, Steve Bono. He's been here for 2 more years, y'all. He kept coming back, and he stayed clean. And he has touched my heart. It's that kind of stuff, man, that lets me know that this program works. And it wasn't me, but it's us, man, because people reach out like that to me. I still try to find the suffering out of you. I still want to be able to show that there's hope, man, that there's another way to do this thing. I still want to show people that, you know, there's the dawn of a new reality is not dead. We can still spread the message of recovery to any addict who can recover. Any addict can recover, y'all. Being selfless, we can affect a lot of people's lives, y'all. Again, I want to thank y'all. It's been a blessing, man, to have the opportunity to come up here and share my experience, strength, and hope. I hope whatever I share has helped someone. I want to say this. If you're struggling through some of the things that I've talked about, don't give up. There's a lot of help out there for us. Share where you are. Talk about this. Don't be a prisoner. Don't push it down and say, I'm recovered. You got to walk through it. My process has been, walk through it, don't let it go. And I found, man, that because I've done that, man, I've been richer for it. I have found so much love as a result of it. And one final thing I want to say before I close out. I mentioned to you guys, my daughter is here. She's got 2 years clean. That is a miracle, y'all. She is a miracle. And this young lady has went through a lot, man. Her mom died. Her mother died, I think it's been about 7 years now, almost 7 years or 8 years, going on 8 years and 7 years. And right after that, she had a child that was born with Apert. If you never heard of it, you can look it up. And she struggled. She struggled, but she found her way to Narcotics Anonymous. And it's not because I pushed this program on her. She found it. And she's in service. She's up in there, up in the windows up there. She's in service for this convention, you know, and I'm just so thankful that God allowed her in the rooms. And man, I love Narcotics Anonymous, man. I love what it's done to me, and I want to thank you guys all, and enjoy the convention. Thank you.